Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war. Where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation, where the rivers run clean through the forests of green, where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace on Earth.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can go to Great Speeches and Interviews blogspot.com, or just friend me on Facebook. Today's program is Are There Reasons for Hope? Bill Moyers examines the deterioration and increasingly corrupt state of affairs that our government has devolved into and the accompanying divisiveness sweeping the country. Is there hope for things to improve? For the first time in his life, Moyers isn't optimistic. And then after that, Tavis Smiley speaks with William Cohan. Award-winning investigative reporter and former investment banker assesses the impact of S&P's downgrading its credit outlook for the U.S. and the taxpayers' subsidies of Goldman Sachs.
Two days after the Tucson massacre, I was sitting in a New York radiology lab waiting for an MRI on a torn left shoulder. It was late evening, and the only other patient in the lounge was a woman with short silver hair who was my senior, and perhaps a slightly senior to me, although that's getting difficult to be these days. We had been there for 2 hours, just the two of us and the receptionist, passing the time by making small talk and sharing a dog-eared copy of the day's New York Times and three very worn copies of People magazine. And now, as time dragged on, 10 o'clock, 10:15 in the evening, we were staring mindlessly at a muted television set high on a wall above the receptionist desk and tuned to a crime show on a cable channel. I think it was A&E. Blood splashed across the screen as killers stalked their victims and in turn were dispatched by police in gory pursuit. I lost count of the bodies and the guns, weapons that could have come right off the racks of the convention of the National Rifle Association. Although there was no sound from the TV, we couldn't miss the reminder that violence sells in America, and the people who profit from violence in real life and popular culture love it. But did you know that between 1933, the year before I was born, and today, more than 1.4 million Americans have been casualties of gunfire? Did you know that between 1979 and 1997, more Americans were killed by guns than have been killed in all of our wars since the Revolution? And yet, in the days just after that massacre, the sale of Glock 9s, the gun used by the killer, doubled in Arizona. and the gun lobby pushed for a bill to allow concealed weapons on college campuses. I made Celeste take hers off a moment ago before she introduced me. This morning's Washington Post, which I read online, a major story on the front page of the Washington Post says the number of guns with high-capacity magazines, like the one used in Tucson, seized by Virginia police, dropped during the 10 years when there was a federal law banning automatic weapons. But when George Bush and the Republican Party and many Democrats pushed for the repeal or the end of that bill in 2004, since then, the number of high-capacity magazines seized by Virginia police rebounded. In other words, the law was beginning to make a dent in the market by the time it ended. President Obama's Tucson memorial speech was eloquent and moving. But I kept waiting for him to say that the great task remaining before us is redeeming America from the fantasy that the law can allow any inflamed lunatic easily to acquire murderous weapons without the expectation of murderous consequences. Alas, no such luck. Instead, the headline on a recent front page of one of my favorite websites, talkingpointsmemo.com, read, "No signs Obama will shift on gun control after Gifford's shooting." It seems that nothing will sufficiently stiffen the backbone of our politicians, including our president, to take on the NRA, which has been perpetrating one of the great frauds of American history, namely that a Jared Lee Loughran, armed with a Glock 9 and a 31-round clip, qualifies as material for the well-regulated militia prescribed by the Constitution. That is just not so. And if you wonder, as I do, how we've reached this stage of democracy where we cannot solve the problems we have created for ourselves, look no further than the overbearing muscle and venal logic of the NRA and its stranglehold on politics. So it is that even in a radiology lab in the heart of Manhattan, ostensibly a neutral zone for healing at that, you can't escape the toxic emissions of a violent culture that has turned democracy into what my friend the media scholar Henry Giroux calls a culture of cruelty. A culture of cruelty. So my waiting room companion and I were sitting there, saying little, when she suddenly turned to me and asked, "Are you optimistic about our country?" "What do you mean?" "Well," she said, "sometimes I sense that it's sinking around me like a great ocean liner, and many of us are not going to make it off." Almost instantly, the metaphor took, and my head was filled with images from James Cameron's epic Titanic. I could see those lifeboats bobbing in the dark waters, the doomed passengers lining the railings of the ship, and the small orchestra gathered on the forward deck playing "Nearer, My God, to Thee." Weird, I thought to myself, that the lady's fears call the cells in my brain to associate the sinking of the Titanic with the fate of democracy. I said nothing to her about it. She seemed forlorn enough. But her question had jolted me. Like so many other Americans, optimism is embedded deep in my psyche. But as with so many other people, it doesn't surface as often these days as it used to. But I didn't say all this to her. Instead, I responded superficially, tongue-in-cheek, half-in-cheek. And I said, "Well, you remind me of the question I once put to a friend of mine on Wall Street. I asked him what he thought about the future of the market. He replied, 'I'm optimistic.' "Then why do you look so worried?" I asked, and he replied, "I'm not sure my optimism is justified." She laughed lightly, just to humor me, I'm sure. And then she persisted. "So, are you optimistic? And if you are, how do you justify your optimism?" I was struggling for an honest answer when the door opened and a technician motioned me to follow him, and I breathed a sigh of relief, said farewell to my melancholy companion, and took my leave. Those of you who've had an MRI know it makes a terrible racket, and it did as I lay in its tubular embrace for almost half an hour. It knocked, whined, and rattled. But I'm telling you the truth, I hardly noticed. Instead, I was focused on her question and my failure to give her more than a trite answer. Let me tell you, as that machine in whose bosom I was entombed began to emit its terminal groans, all I could hear from some distant place were the strains of "Nearer, My God, to Thee." Make of that what you will. But on the subway home that night, and many, many times since, I've thought of our conversation and her question. If she were here today, I don't know her name, I can't track her down, but if she were here today, here is how I would answer her. I am an optimist, because human beings are capable of goodness. I see it around me in my wife, Judith, and family, in my friends and colleagues, and of course in the world far beyond my own circle. If you were following news of the recent floods that are ravaging huge swaths of Australia, you may have heard about the two brothers, one of them 13, the other 10, who were in the car with their mother when a wall of water crashed down on them. Rescuers struggled to reach them, but only one got through. He realized that the force of the flood was so fierce that he could only get one of them to safety at a time. When the older boy recognized this too, he insisted the rescuer take the younger brother first. The man did, managing to carry the boy to higher ground and start back to the car. But before he could get there, the older brother and their mother were washed away. The tragedies of life would be unspeakable, would they not? Except for something in the human being, even in a 13-year-old, that will say, if you can only save one of us, save my brother. And the heroes of the Tucson massacre, the older man, 3 years older than I am, who threw himself across his wife to protect her. She lived, he died. The two bystanders, one of them bleeding from his own head wounds, who jumped the gunman as he tried to reload, and the woman who grabbed the clip as he tried to reload, and the student intern, no older than you, who was on Representative Gifford's staff, whose first instinct was to run toward his fallen leader, using his high school training in emergency medicine to slow her bleeding and probably save her life. All around us, look around. I mean, look to your left, would you? Now to your right. All around us are heroes with 1,000 faces. Joseph Campbell wrote a book with that title years ago. Many of you will remember Joe Campbell, the scholar of comparative religion and literature who became one of our foremost mythologists. His archives are just a few miles from here, and Carol, are you here? You were going to come, yes, back there, who manages that wonderful place. My conversations with him on the power of myth filmed at George Lucas's Skywalker Ranch here in California, became the most popular of the many series I've done for PBS. In one of them, Joe was explaining the influence on his thinking of the philosopher Schopenhauer, who in a famous essay had once asked himself, "How is it that a human being can so participate in the peril or pain of another human being that without thought, spontaneously, he or she sacrifices his own life to the other? How can it happen," Schopenhauer asked, "that what we normally think of as the first law of nature and self-preservation is suddenly dissolved, and we put another's well-being ahead of our own?" Campbell then told me a story that had unfolded near his home in Hawaii at a place called the Pali, I think that's the pronunciation of it, where the trade winds from the north come rushing through a great ridge of mountains. People go up there to have their hair blown in the winds, if they have it, and sometimes they go up there to commit suicide, like jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. "One day," said Joe, "two policemen were driving up the Pali Road when they saw just beyond the railing a young man about to jump. One of the policemen leaped from the car and grabbed him, but the momentum of the two of them going over at the same time almost carried them off the cliff together. The policeman wouldn't let go. And just in time, his partner arrived and pulled the two of them back. When a newspaper reporter asked the first policeman, 'Why didn't you let go? You could have been killed.' He answered, 'I couldn't let go. If I had, I wouldn't have lived another day of my life.'" Campbell then asked me, "Do you realize what had suddenly happened to that policeman who had given himself over to death to save a stranger? Everything else in his life had dropped off. The wishes and hopes for a lifetime no longer mattered. What mattered was saving that young man, even at the cost of his own life." "How come?" "Because," said Campbell, interpreting Schopenhauer, "such a psychological crisis represents the breakthrough of a metaphysical reality, which is that you and the other are two aspects of the one life, and your apparent separateness is but an effect of the way we experience forms under the conditions of space and time. Our true reality," he said, "our true reality is our identity and unity with all life." Perhaps that's another way of saying we're all in this together. And perhaps the Hindus, I think it is, a sect, had it right that when you give the traditional greeting, you're recognizing the divinity in the other of which you are a part. In mythology, the hero gives us his or her life, gives his or her life to some order of realization of this truth. Campbell said, "This is also the truth of your life." And he was saying it to me. "This is the truth of your life." As I'm saying it to you, this is the truth of your life and your life and your life. It's the reason each of us harbors within us, and it's why I ask you to look left and right. It's the reason each of us harbors within us a potential hero. You're sitting next to two potential heroes, and one is sitting in your seat. Take the imperative that we love our neighbor, one of the hardest of all religious concepts. If I were a Catholic, I would have to go to confession every day because I don't love all my neighbors. But Campbell said, it puts us in tune with this truth. But whether you love your neighbors or not, and I confess, as I said, that I've had neighbors I would just let drop off that bridge. One of them cut down all the trees behind our house once after he bought his house. When this truth claims you, when it holds you, when it rises from within you, you may risk everything for someone else and not really know why you do so. Who can forget? I can't forget. My wife and I were awake that morning. We lived 3 hours from Ground Zero, and our offices were 3 miles from Ground Zero, and our office is 1 mile from Ground Zero. And we heard about the second plane on the way to our television station where we spent the next week helping to keep it on the air because our engineer had been killed in the technical facilities above the World Trade Center, the transmission. The heroes of the hour, as many of you remember, were first responders who sprang into action when the terrorists struck the World Trade Center. Most were public employees drawing a modest middle-class income for extremely dangerous work. All these years later here in Santa Barbara, I can see in my mind's eye those firemen who just kept climbing, going up those darkened stairs through billowing smoke toward roaring flames. In the midst of all that horror, they held on to their humanity and did their duty at the cost of their own lives. You will want to read the new book by Rebecca Solnit, one of our finest nonfiction writers. Its title is A Paradise Built in Hell, and it's a study of what people do in disasters and why it matters. Ultimately, it's about human goodness and why it matters. Solnit sets straight those Hollywood producers and directors who relish making films that show terrified mobs screaming in the streets after calamity and turning to looting, murder, and cannibalism. Not so, she writes. Spurred by her own experience in California's Loma Prieta earthquake, she began to dig deeply into other disasters, the 1917 explosion in Halifax, Nova Scotia, the 1985 Mexico City earthquake, 9/11 in New York, and Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. She reports that in the aftermath of each calamity, ordinary people become altruistic, resourceful, and brave, striving to save other people's lives or reaching out to strangers with random acts of kindness. Paradoxically, they often find in the aftermath of disaster the sense of community and purpose that is otherwise absent from their lives. That's the message of the book. The desires and possibilities are so powerful that they shine from wreckage, carnage, and ashes. Now, of course, it doesn't take disasters to bring out goodness. What Schopenhauer was saying in his celebrated essay is that in small ways we can see this happening every day, all the time, moving in the world, people doing selfless things to and for each other. Rebecca Solnit eloquently dwells on this, and I couldn't recommend this book to you more highly. She says, what sustains life is far closer to home and more essential than market forces and much more interesting than selfishness. Most of the real work on this planet, she said, is not done for profit. It's done at home, for each other, for affection, out of idealism. And it starts with the heroic effort of parents to sustain each helpless human being, a child, for all those years before fending for yourself becomes feasible. And it's not just confined to home. What she called, and I love this term, a shadow system of kindness provides soup kitchens, food pantries, and giveaways, takes in the unemployed, evicted, and foreclosed upon, defends the indigent and the immigrant, tutors the poorly schooled, comforts the neglected, provides loans, gifts, donations, and a thousand other forms of practical solidarity, as well as emotional support.
So Now for something completely different.